Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
History of this, the budget resolution, Senate Resolution 14, covered fiscal years 2023 through 2031. It passed on August 24th of 2021.
Jonathan Kappas, a farm policy expert, University of Illinois.
Within that were instructions to the Senate Ag Committee to report changes that did not report changes under their jurisdiction that increased the deficit by not more than $135 billion through 2031. And of course, this is what then led to nearly a year's worth of negotiations to produce the Inflation Reduction Act, which was signed into law by President Biden on August 16th. So that's kind of a quick overview of the steps that Congress went through since over the last year plus to achieve this legislation.
This is Agriculture Today.
The recession's coming. The Fed's raised rates quite a lot, and they're not finished raising rates. By the time we finish this rate rising cycle, they're probably going to raise rates by another 100 basis points, or roughly 1 percentage point, probably half a percentage point at the next meeting in early December, and then another half a point, maybe 0.75 point in the first couple, 2 or 3 meetings next year.
Elliot Eisenberg is an economist with Graphs and Laughs.
So we'll be end up being a little over 5% on Fed's funds. In less than a year, we'll have gone from 0 to over 5%. It's a big increase. The recession will come sometime in 23, and probably second or third quarter is my guess, maybe late first quarter, but it's almost guaranteed at this point.
He spoke at the recent ABA Ag Bankers Conference in Omaha. Well, the U.S. economy still has considerable momentum and is not currently on the verge of recession. That's a statement from Dan Kowalski, Vice President of CoBank's Knowledge Exchange. He says, however, economists have never been more pessimistic, and there are very legitimate reasons for concern. He says in the past, according to this new CoBank report, inflation in excess of 5% has never been tamed without a recession. As financial conditions continue to tighten, he says we expect the U.S. economy will steadily soften through the first half of 23, ushering in a brief, modest recession. Now, an area of concern, indirect decline in consumer spending if unemployment rates climb to 5% or higher. He says without the softening in the labor market and the associated slowing of wage gains and spending, it will be difficult to stabilize prices. Now, inflation last month lower than expected as the U.S. economy experiences a broad-based slowdown in consumer prices. On Tuesday morning, government reported the consumer price index climbed over 7% last month over the reading from November of 21. Despite the increase, it was the smallest since last December. Now, CNBC is reporting the average U.S. household spent $396 more per month to buy the same goods and services it did a year ago. In October, that was $433. That according to Moody Analytics. Well, after experiencing some historic levels of tractor sales in the U.S., total ag equipment unit sales fell during the month of November, according to the Association of Equipment Manufacturers, or AEM, losses capped by the small utility tractor market, which fell nearly 28% year over year. Now, this segment expected to fall after seeing huge sell increases during the height of the pandemic. That's according to Kurt Blades. He's Senior Vice President, Industry Sectors and Product Leadership at AEM. Combine harvester sales remain positive with an 8.3% year-over-year increase and 100-plus horsepower tractor sales increasing by more than 6%, as both segments are the only in the farm equipment sales category to see year-to-year or year-to-date gains. For tractors, it's up combines, 15.7% increase, and then for the larger tractors, 13.3%, and again, that is a year-to-date gain. I'm Tony St. James. It's Agriculture Today.
We'll be right back. You're listening to Agriculture Today.
It's my only time serving in government ever in any capacity. I've spent the last 20 years working really with farmers and within the ag sector on the private sector side in a variety of capacities, the Corn Growers, Crop Life America, Field to Market.
Rod Snyder is EPA Senior Advisor for Ag.
I think all of that really prepared me for this kind of a role, to try to bring really practical perspectives and expertise into the agency. Folks asked why I didn't go over to USDA. I said because they have tons of ag experts. I wanted to make sure that within EPA that someone that has the direct ear of the administrator has this type of expertise to help advise on these kinds of issues, and it's really been a rewarding experience so far.
At the end of the day, farmers have the answer to climate concerns.
All of these activities are happening during a time when the Biden administration has made climate change a key policy priority, and it's really encouraging to see the discussion here this morning, the panel just before, really with the focus around how the renewable fuels sector and ethanol can be part of the climate solution. As someone who's been working on these climate issues now for quite a long time, I took a delegation of farmers to the UN Climate Summit in Copenhagen back in 2009, and I felt like people looked at me like I had three heads. Why are we taking farmers to a UN Climate Summit? And I have felt for a very long time that the ag sector is really uniquely positioned to help deliver climate solutions, one of the only segments of the economy that can actually act as a carbon sink. And clearly, the ag commodities that are the feedstocks for renewable fuels are a critical piece of that conversation. And so it's great to see within industry events like this that being so front and center. So I do want to state emphatically that as I've spoken with Administrator Regan a lot over the last 10 months, he believes that biofuels and ethanol are an important piece of our strategy to help the U.S. meet our long-term climate goals. And of course, meeting greenhouse gas emission thresholds is a fundamental underpinning of our implementation of the RFS. The agency is aware that the science and practice of producing renewable fuels have come a long way since we finalized the assessment that was the basis of the 2010 RFS rule with respect to greenhouse gases and LCAs. To that end, EPA has initiated work to develop a revised modeling framework that would be applied to analyze the GHG impacts associated with biofuels. The agency hosted a workshop on February 28th and March 1st with our federal partners at USDA and DOE regarding greenhouse gas accounting for renewable fuels. The goal of the workshop was to begin a process to update our life cycle analysis framework for biofuels so we can more accurately assess and model GHG emissions. The workshop was well attended. We're pleased with the amount of valuable information that was presented by a number of experts. We're now moving on to the next step in this process, which is conducting what we are calling a modeling comparison exercise. The model comparison exercise will feature models discussed in the workshop and explore further details about these tools. We expect to share additional information on our work in this particular area in the Federal Register or an upcoming RFS rulemaking in the near future, so please stay tuned on that front. USDA and DOE are key partners in this work, and we consult with their teams regularly as we as part of the comparison exercise work. We are also actively participating in cross-agency teams looking at LCA topics, for example, also looking at sustainable aviation fuels, which has been discussed this morning.
Talks about a change in approach at EPA.
Earlier this spring, the administrator announced a new charge topic for EPA's Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Federal Advisory Committee, which I have the privilege of staffing. We'll be focusing the work of this committee for the next 2 years at the nexus of climate and agriculture. I think that's the first time in the history of the Farm, Ranch, and Rural Communities Committee that that has been the express focus. This includes evaluating all the ways in which the ag sector can be part of the climate solution, including through the production of low-carbon biofuels.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
For sure it's education, and I hesitate to say that on the other side of the aisle that we're going to get past the emotional side of this.
Talking about patiently informing other members, August Pfluger, the only sheep and goat raiser in Congress.
It's important for us to be able to set the conditions and stay out of private industry's business when it comes to their ability, you know, to get things done. And that's really the education we need to provide, is to take other members of Congress out there and groups to see how hard it is, you know, that life cycle. We're talking about, you know, the over a year-long process for the life cycle of a young lamb or a kid goat. So to protect them once they're born, it's incredibly important and difficult.
Pfluger from Texas, with a deep background in ag, says trade remains a top priority.
Sitting on foreign affairs, I also sit on the subcommittee that deals with trade, and this is how I can be an advocate, a voice, and an educator on why it's so important for our agricultural trade. I mean, just take U.S.-Mexico-Canada, the agreement that we had. Texas is Mexico's largest trading partner, and a lot of those products come from West Texas, whether it's cotton or beef, sheep and goats, or anything. And so we do need a level playing field, and I think it was nice to see the other side of the aisle come to the table and say, yes, this is something we want, especially through the Rio Grande Valley. They know how important that is for us to be able to export those products. And so what you'll get out of me is somebody who has a passion for agriculture but also understands trade and why it's so important that countries like China and other ones be held accountable for unfair trading practices, which is exactly what President Trump did in these trade agreements that he did over the last 3 or 4 years.
Also talks about the importance of a safety net.
And I don't have to tell anybody this in West Texas right now, the drought that we've been through, and thank goodness in the last couple of weeks we've gotten some rain. And, you know, that's when you depend on things that are out of our control, like the weather, for your livelihood. And I look at this as a national security issue. We cannot be dependent on other countries for our food source. We cannot be dependent on anybody else. We have the resources in this country, and we need to take it in that perspective, that this is a national security issue. The pandemic taught a lot of us that, and we're going to continue to educate other people who didn't quite get there, potentially on the other side of the aisle, that food doesn't grow on a shelf, and it takes a long time to get there. It takes a lot of persistence. So having a safety net where the farmers and the ranchers, whether it's a livestock indemnity program or WIP Plus, which takes into account natural disasters, which a drought has been authorized for the last couple of years, those are very critical to help our producers sustain their business and feed this country.
Representing the Permian Basin, that's oil and gas.
We have seen a rebound. Thankfully, their production numbers are back up. Rig count is back up. Unfortunately for Americans, and in large part due to some of the policies that we see coming out of the Biden administration, where there is a full-on assault against the oil and gas industry, we as Americans are going to see higher prices at the pump. Some of these are natural forces, but a lot of these have been are a result of the policies that we've seen. So I look at this the same way I do as agriculture, that this is a national security issue. And you're going to hear me say that a lot, but it is when you're providing affordable, reliable energy, not just to Texans, but also throughout the rest of our country. And in fact, we are now the number one producer in the world, exporting more than we import. And we've lowered emissions. We've done all the right things. And the other side of the aisle is now really bent on cutting our knees out and ending this industry.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
On the money provided to these programs, the existing conservation programs, EQIP, CSP, ACEP, and RCPP.
Jonathan Kappas is a former administrator of USDA's Farm Service Agency, a farm policy expert at the University of Illinois.
There are provisions in each one of the components of the Inflation Reduction Act that provides this funding that instructs the secretary that all of the spending provided under that, so the additional spending from the Inflation Reduction Act is limited to or sort of contained, or the parameters around that spending is for one or more agricultural conservation practices or enhancements that the secretary determines will improve soil carbon, reduce nitrogen losses, reduce capture, avoid or sequester carbon dioxide, methane or nitrous oxide emissions that is associated with agricultural production. So what this is just a reminder that these additional funds are not for all conservation practices. This is not for the entire authorized Farm Bill set of practices and enhancements, but really focusing in on those things that help with climate change, that help address greenhouse gas emissions from agriculture, or help farmers and agricultural operations sequester or capture greenhouse gases, all in that effort to help agriculture help address climate change. Again, just kind of highlighting all of these issues to kind of put us in context a little bit. This is the May 2022 CBO baseline that we put out on the Farm Doc a while back when it was released. Just a reminder, this is what the committees will have to work with in baseline funding, Title I, Title II conservation, crop insurance, and then the large item for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, used to be known as food stamps. And as we've talked about many times, when the committees go in to reauthorize the Farm Bill, if they do so in 2023, as it's scheduled to expire, This is the pot of money. This is what they have to work with. Under budget rules, you can't spend above your baseline in the 10-year window. So this is kind of what they have to work with. It's yet to be determined exactly how the new budget authority will spend out and how the new items for the conservation programs, the new funding appropriated for the conservation programs, will impact or alter or influence the way Congress works under its baseline rules. Again, just kind of highlighting the baseline for conservation programs here as it exists. And again, it'll be next year's baseline that will control any Farm Bill reauthorization effort in 2023. So coming back to this slide, just to give you kind of the full come full circle on the baseline and spending items. Again, what we're looking at from the Inflation Reduction Act is not an increase in the mandatory spending for conservation programs under the CCC, the Commodity Credit Corporation. It is a separate appropriated amount into those programs over the course of those fiscal years, the spending of which has yet to be scored. And then finally, just to give you the program by program breakdown of what was provided in the Inflation Reduction Act to these conservation programs in terms of additional spending. There's funding in there that begins for fiscal year 2022, most of that for technical assistance, $1 billion for technical assistance, about $300 million to quantify greenhouse gas emissions and reductions and really help kind of step up or push progress being able to measure, validate, and verify what's going on. And then you see the main conservation programs that receive funding. So the Regional Conservation Partnership Program and the Environmental Quality Incentives Programs were received the largest share of the appropriations each year. ACEP, the Conservation Easement Program, and the Conservation Stewardship Program also got significant additions in funding.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Passing a budget, that's not easy. By the way, I've been involved with several budgets. I was involved, heavily involved in the 2017 debt ceiling increase from President Trump. Hard they are. You all know I know how hard they are and how messy they are and how partisan they are.
Mick Mulvaney is the former director of the Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, and the former White House budget director, talking about debt and Congress.
Budgets are the same way. Appropes are the same way. Congress hasn't passed all 12 appropriations bills since 1996. Just because it's hard, does that mean we want to stop doing it? I think no one ran on a campaign slogan that said, send me to Washington so I don't have to do anything hard, so I don't have to take any messy votes, so that I don't actually have to make any hard decisions. Ask yourself this. How often would you, as members of Congress, be talking about the debt and the deficit if not for the debt ceiling? I can't remember it ever coming up on the floor of the House when we were there outside of that. Yeah, we talked about it during some of the appropriations markups and so forth. But generally speaking, it never came to the forefront. That's what this debt ceiling does. And I happen to think it does it well. Ask yourself this question. Would Congress be more or less likely to be prudent with how they manage their taxpayer dollars with or without the rule? Ask yourself this. Would our debt situation be better or worse if we didn't have the bill? Yes, we've not fixed it. And yes, the long-term trends are very bad. But would it be better or worse if we had not had the debt ceiling rules available to us? The bottom line, I think, is this. The rule's not broken. The rule does exactly what it is supposed to do. It forces us to have a discussion that we otherwise would not have, and from time to time allows us to pass legislation that we otherwise would not pass. The debt ceiling gave us Graham Rudman Hollins. The debt ceiling gave us the Omnibus Act in 1991, which led to a balanced budget by the end of that decade. The debt ceiling gave us the Budget Control Act of 2011. Were these fixes, permanent fixes to our deficits and our debts? No, they absolutely weren't. In fact, we voted as a body to undo a lot of those things as we moved forward. But we never would have had those without the debt ceiling. The rules are not broken. Congress is broken. And the reason it's so hard to do this, it doesn't have to be hyperbolic. There's nothing in the rule that says this has to be divisive and hyperbolic and brinksmanship. That's not in the rule. That's how you as it. That's how we addressed it as a body when I was there. The rule is not broken. Congress is not broken. Excuse me, Congress is what's broken, and I think what we should be spending our time on is fixing that. And then you fix that, you get a chance to fix the debt ceiling, get a chance to fix the appropriations process, get a chance to fix the budget process, and by doing that, you get better fiscal outcomes.
Mulvaney, a former member of Congress as well, as we stare down $31.4 trillion in debt. That's $94,000 per citizen. But he says it's not just on the back of Democrats. Republicans helped.
I think it's fair to say that not as many Republicans care about the debt and deficit as I want them to. I'll never forget, I was walking down the hallway early in my days in Congress, what we all refer to as the old bulls. I honestly can't remember his name, so I'm not shielding him. And I just got there in the Tea Party wave, and he looked at me and says, "Oh, you're Mulvaney. You're one of those fiscal hawks." And I said, "Yeah." And he laughs. And he said, "Yeah, you know, y'all came around a little bit with Newt, and then you left, and I was here. You were around a little bit with Reagan, you left, and I was here. Now you're here, and I'm here. You're going to leave, and I'm still going to be here." There are Republicans who love spending money just as much as Democrats do.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
EPA partners with states, with territories, and tribes to oversee the program.
Alfredo Gomez, Director of Natural Resources at the GAO, Government Accountability Office.
And what EPA does is EPA, with the states, conduct a variety of activities, including inspections and identifying violations. States are required to report on their inspections and enforcement activities to EPA. Facilities also monitor and report their pollutant discharge levels. This is important because this allows EPA to automatically calculate whether a facility is exceeding its discharge limits. And this helps EPA and the states track illegal discharges and pollution.
It's talking about EPA's permits under the CWA Clean Water Act and the transition to electronic monitoring.
So EPA began in 2015 to require states and facilities to electronically report their program and permit information, such as inspections, discharge levels, and violations. This gives EPA one of the most comprehensive databases among the environmental programs that it administers to oversee the Clean Water Act. However, we found that there are issues with the completeness and accuracy of the data that EPA collects. For example, we found that only 2 of the 17 state programs that EPA reviewed had accurate and complete data. Also, the transition to electronic reporting is ongoing. There have been a number of challenges experienced by states and facilities during this transition. For example, some states have had problems entering facility permit limits into the database.
What are EPA's goals?
EPA does track and annually report results of its compliance and enforcement activities. For example, EPA sets a goal for pollution reduction that it hopes to achieve through its enforcement. It also periodically selects a set of national initiatives that identify priority areas for its compliance and enforcement programs. One of EPA's current set of initiatives focuses on the Clean Water Act, specifically improving water quality by reducing the rate of significant noncompliance by a subset of permitted facilities. However, we found that inaccurate and incomplete permit limit and facility discharge data makes the results of EPA measures unclear.
Why is the Government Accountability Office talking about the Clean Water Act? Well, they have recommendations.
We made several recommendations to EPA to improve data quality and better inform the public and other users of the data about its limitations. So, for example, we recommended that EPA consolidate disclosures about known problems and data limitations on its website, and to keep them updated. We also recommended that EPA develop a plan to analyze the overall accuracy of the permit limit and facility discharge data in its national database. And we recommended that EPA develop a quantifiable measure for assessing improvements to water quality resulting from increased compliance with the permits.
So what's the bottom line?
The bottom line is that EPA and the states collect a lot of data to oversee and enforce the Clean Water Act. And it's important that that data are complete and accurate. We have made several recommendations to improve the quality of the data.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
You can find this report in an executive summary, because it is a lengthy report. Most of our listeners will probably like the five-page summary more, on agmanager.info, as most of our references and resources are there. The title of the project is called Assessing Economic Impact That Would Follow Loss of U.S. Beef Exports and Imports. Yes, that's a long title, but it also tells you, basically, the punchline is Daryl and I were tasked with describing why we trade beef. All this is international, it's not interstate, it's with other countries, both importing of beef as well as exporting of beef.
Kansas State livestock economist Glenn Tonzer on recent work with Oklahoma State's Daryl Peel.
So a fair amount of our lengthy report is just documenting patterns in imports and exports. And then the kind of the back end of it was quantifying what would happen if we did not. So if for any reason we ceased to trade, regardless of why that is, if we quit importing and exporting beef, what would be the economic impact of that? So that gives a quick summary of, you know, the title, where you can find it, kind of what we did.